This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we have a really extraordinary guest. Gary Lachman is with us. Not many members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are recognized authority on the Western inner tradition, the occult, and the world of the mystical. But Gary is. He has gone from being one of the founders of Blondie as Gary Valentine, and through an incredible life. And we're going to explore that with Gary today. He started as a rock and roller, then became a writer on consciousness in the Western tradition, and has had a tremendous journey. He knew people that I also knew, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs. He's been involved with the Gurdjieff Foundation, as I have indeed also. He is the author also of The Return of Holy Russia, Maurice Nicole, Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way, and Dark Star Rising. I am a student of Maurice Nicole's work. I've read it many times and discussed it deeply. It's terribly important work. Gary, welcome to Dreamland. I'm so proud to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Touched by the presence. It's really an incredible life journey. But let's start with the 70s and CBGBs and Blondie and that world. I lived about three blocks from CBGBs in those days. I don't recall ever seeing you there, but I may have. I don't know that we saw Blondie, but we went a lot. Ann and I did, my wife. So,
well, I lived at 266 Bowery, which was the south side of Houston Street, which was a bit further down. William Burroughs had his bunker. That whole area, actually recently I did a map. There's a company called Herb Lester here in the UK, and I've done a series of sort of cultural maps for them. And I did one about the New York underground scene. So all these places, I've mapped them out where they are. And this all happens, well, a couple things are above 14th Street, but it relatively is between 14th Street and Houston Street. But no, I lived there in 1975. This became known as the Blondie Loft. And it was just, just the other side of Houston from CBGB, the other side of the street, but right, the other side of Houston. And
did you ever spend any time at Max's?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, we played there. There was the original Max's in the heyday, Mickey Ruskin when he had it, and then he let it go, and then he got a couple of ventures downtown. There was the Ocean Club was one thing, and there was a couple other things. But then somebody else took over Max's, not that long after CBGB's had really got going. There was a lot of press about it. And so Blondie, we played in both places. And when I had my own band later on, The No, we played in Max's quite a bit, not so much CBGB's, but there. But I was living there. I was actually in that milieu, and I was living in this dilapidated loft space with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, that I first came across the sort of thing that I've subsequently made a life work out of reading. This was his introduction to Aleister Crowley. There was this wild, flamboyant, gay biker artist who had the lease, insofar as there was such a thing, on this building, and who rented us our floor. And he used to do these impromptu tarot readings with Crowley's Thoth tarot deck and things like that. And then the other book, the book that literally changed my life, was this book just called The Occult by Colin Wilson. And it was such a well-written, compelling narrative, as the best blurbs say, about this world that I didn't know anything about, that I just became completely, completely fascinated with it.
But you were attracted to it, and that's interesting because most people in that community weren't I mean, they did, some did, and I've talked to some of them, but who in the community drew you toward this material or
Well,
anybody?
there was one single person, was this fellow, his name was Benton Quinn. He passed away some years ago. But he had the lease on this building, and there were three
Right.
floors. And so funnily enough, the last time I was in New York, pre-COVID in 2019, I went to my old neighborhood, and everywhere else is completely unrecognizable. My joke is, forget the rents, you can't afford the cappuccinos. It's just like, so skyrocketed. But this place where we lived, it looked exactly the same, and I was so gratified to see it had graffiti on the door, and the restaurant supply shop was still there, and there was a liquor
Oh, I
store
know the
still.
building then. I know exactly
Yeah,
what you're talking
no. Literally, if you're on Bowery, the other side of the street from CBGB's, and from
Right.
Bleecker on, you just walk south, you'll pass it. I mean,
You put
it's
past there because that, yeah, that restaurant supply place is
266
still there.
Bowery. So if you're down there, but any case, he was the person who, he was the gateway keeper for me, this fellow, and he also, for many other reasons as well, he introduced me to Persky, for whom I wrote a song called "I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear," which is about these psychic experiences we had together, and that's the title of the book is an allusion to that. But the thing was, it was the previous generation, it was the '60s generation that had magic and the occult kind of in the foreground, and the way I subsequently described it, there was like the debris from that generation still kind of hanging on in the mid '70s in people's apartments and things and bookshelves and things like that. So High Priest by Leary or Castaneda's books and that sort of stuff. That's how I came across Wilson's Occult. I mean, I just found it on somebody's bookshelf. It was Tommy Ramone's bookshelf, the original drummer from the Ramones, who's another who has passed away.
Yeah. Was
So so
Tommy
that
into
was,
this?
I mean, I just think it was something that was just there. People just had these books and they read this stuff. I mean, when I
Right,
live with
that.
Chris and Debbie, they had a kitschy kind of fun poppy camp interest in voodoo and stuff. So it was this kind of atmosphere. It was this sort of bric-a-brac in a way
And
around.
anyone who goes from there to Aleister Crowley and Maurice Nicole and G.I. Gurdjieff is no dilettante. I mean, that's a serious journey, man.
Well, I mean, that got me interested. I just that was I mean, I had read, I mean, the first serious stuff I read was like 1970, a hippie girl I had a crush on gave me a copy of Hesse's Siddhartha. So that was like the first serious literature. Before that, I was a great reader of weird pulp fiction like H.P. Lovecraft and that kind of thing. And comic books were the really thing that got me going in the first place. I mean,
You know, that's
the comic books from
interesting.
this, sorry, go.
No, I'm just saying that trajectory is very familiar to me. As I was into EC Comics when I was young, and my father, I told Stephen King the story of my father throwing him out the window. And then I see Creepshow, and it starts with this father throwing guys EC Comics out the window. And I thought, I wonder
Right,
must have made an impression on him.
yeah.
Anyway, I haven't seen him, but I don't know him. I don't want to give that impression. I don't know Stephen King at all. But I met him once and at a party, and I told the story to about 20 people at the party. So, anyway, the trajectory from comics to the kind of the Lovecraft world, and I was so fascinated with that. I knew a guy named Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho and quite a
Well, of
famous author, and we were friends.
course.
And we decided at one point that, there'd never been a Lovecraft novel, and that we would have a bet that one of us could write an entire novel in the Lovecraft world. And I did it, actually. I did. It's called The Forbidden Zone. And it on the cover is a big blurb from Bob because we said so it was I was really into that stuff. And then
No, I mean, well, he's fantastic. I mean, he's actually a character in one of Lovecraft's last stories, The Haunter of the Dark. As I said, I did this map about the New York scene. I also did one about Lovecraft. His places
oh.
in Providence, but also where he lived in New York and in Brooklyn, and you know, the horror at Red Hook and all of that, which is the horror of Clinton Street, which is where he lived in Brooklyn. So, but no, I mean, I got so into, I mean, the gateway for me was actually the Robert E. Howard Conan stories, and that's because I was fascinated. I love the Frank Frazetta covers of the Lancer paperbacks. And if you know, again, this is the Silver Age, this is the 1960s. So I'm from that time. And they're these fantastic, you know, sensual, muscular, and these incredibly buxom women that are always there with the monsters. And it's like, you know, so I'm adolescent. And so I got into the Howard stuff. And then it was like Weird Tales, so the trajectory, but then Clark Ashton Smith, who was much more lapidary. Through him, because he talked about the French symbolists and Baudelaire and Gautier and things like that. So there was this whole kind of everything just opened up. So that was the early, like, comic books, pulp literature, what was called adult fantasy. There was a writer and editor named Lynn Carter back then, who for Ballantine paperbacks, he edited the series in the late 60s and early 70s, like E.R.R. Edison. This was the aftermath of the Tolkien explosion, you know, when Tolkien became
Yes.
very popular on the campus, and suddenly this kind of fantasy was money making and all that.
Right, and it came out of, and those balance, a lot of those Ballantine paperbacks were pretty wonderful, I
Oh,
thought.
yeah.
That was a wonderful series. Now, you mentioned, we talked about Lovecraft. You mentioned also the influence of Hesse and Siddhartha, which of course is a book that opened spirituality to a lot of people. A couple of years ago, I went to India, and one of the places, of course, I really wanted to go was to sit under the Bodhi tree, even though it's not the original Bodhi tree, it's a cutting from it now, but never the original, having being in Sri Lanka. It was an awesome experience for me, and reading Siddhartha was what it drew me. It's one of the things that drew me ultimately toward the Gurdjieff work. And I wonder about if you could tell us about your impressions of Siddhartha.
Well, I mean, this was 1970. I was on my way to being 15. It was during this time where Hesse was having this fantastic posthumous, you know, bestsellerdom.
Right.
All of his books. And I mean, one of the funny things, and I write about this in Touched by Your Presence, but also in actually my first book was called Turn Off Your Mind, and it was about the 1960s. The occult revival of the 1960s, part of which was I dealt with the Hesse revival. And I mean, even though he was picked up by the Beats and, you know, kind of the counterculture in Germany, he was like a recognized, you know, author. So he wasn't quite the rebel, even though he wrote about that sort of thing. So it was an odd kind of strange third life for him here. But I was completely taken up with them. Once I read Siddhartha, it was like I wanted to read all of them and I wanted to learn German. And then there was all these other strange people whose names I was, you know, mispronouncing, Goethe and Nitzka. And it's
Goethe.
like, you know, and it's
That's not
like,
too far from
I'm thinking,
Goff.
well, who are these guys? You know, and I'm trying to like, so, and I'm tracking them down and all that. And one of the remarkable things for me, and I have to say, I'm so grateful this happened, was I tell the story of in my last year in high school. I had this young progressive English teacher. I got kicked out of the other class I was in, and I later was put into his class. And he somehow saw my, you know, who I was and thought I was reading everything, all this other stuff. And he started teaching me something on the side. He started handing me books to read on the side. He taught the rest of the class whatever the regular curriculum was. And he was handing me Sartre and Nietzsche and stuff like that. So it was just this was incredible. I don't know if that happens anymore these days. It's like kind of like Dead Poets Society or something like that, but it was absolutely
Well, it
fantastic.
does. It does in this country. It does in the private schools, not so much in the public schools, because they have very strict rules regarding curriculum. And that's my oldest grandchild dropped out of public school and school altogether for that reason, and just became his own teacher, and it has a fabulous education as a result of it. He's just graduated from school. He has He's got an official diploma from
Sure. No,
the
of course,
school,
yeah.
but
Sure.
he basically created his own curriculum. And
Well, I mean, I did something similar in my teenage years because I spent a lot of time at the library, and
yeah,
I just
that's
like
exactly
I
what
just
he
like
did.
haunted the what they call the stacks, and it's just whatever it was I was interested in. I just would get a, I was never so happy as when I had like a pile of books in front of me on one of these decks back in the, the cobweb corners of the stacks where nobody goes to, and I would just like read all this indiscriminate stuff and all that. But I mean, the thing with
Yeah.
Hesse, the two Hesse novels that really affected me in my teenage years were it was Beneath the Wheel,
I
which
haven't
is
read
this
that.
that that well, this is like it's an earlier one than the ones that were very popular, like Siddhartha and Steppenwolf and Damien and all. Damien was the other big one for me. Beneath the Wheel is one of these Bildungsroman. It's one of these educational novels where there's a character who's crushed by the system and there's another character who's somehow escapes. And so but at the time it was very much about being in school and having to sort of submit to authority and things of that kind of stuff. And but Damien was the one that, I mean, I subsequently understood it's this, it's this kind of journey through the Jungian in path of individuation, really, which in one sense, in a humble way, I'd like to think my memoir, Touched by the Presence, is something like that, because it is kind of like my story of how I became who I am. And that was in the beginning of this Damien, there's a copy I had. It said something like, I only wanted to follow the promptings of my true self. Why was that so difficult? And you would think this would be the easiest thing in the world, but it actually turns out to be the most difficult thing you could possibly try to do.
Yes, to find that, to really find it, because we hide very skillfully from ourselves. Now, let me think of it. Let's go to Crowley and Thelema. And Crowley, for those of you folks who do not know who Aleister Crowley was, he was cons called by the press to be the most evil man in the world. But that's not quite what was going on. You tell us a little bit about Crowley.
Well, it was also the wickedest man in the world.
Wicked, I guess it was wickedest.
That was the phrase. And it's funny that you say that, because this is in the 1920s, so it's literally a century ago. And the other thing they said, the man we like to hang, and these were all what they used to call the red top, sensational rag sheet newspapers, the scandal sheets. But they said he's the man we'd like to hang. And the funny thing is, in London today, there's the National Portrait Gallery. I mean, it's been around forever, but down in Trafalgar Square, it's one of these fantastic, galleries that are open to the public. But this is all figures from the UK, from Great Britain, important people. And Crowley is the man they'd like to hang because he is well hung. There's actually a portrait of him in this National Portrait Gallery, which is the strangest thing, because he was considered,
Yeah.
this, as you say, this evil character, but now he's considered kind of a national treasure. And a friend of mine said, this is how the British deal with these kind of characters. First you sort of vilify them, then you accept them as an eccentric, the British eccentric, and then you become the national treasure. So that's a long parenthetical remark about who Aleister Crowley was. But he's known as sort of the most famous or infamous magician of the 20th century, in sense of not prestidigitation, but actual, magic in the old school
Now,
of magic.
when you say magician, you mean something very different from what probably crosses through most minds, which is somebody who can take pigeons out of a hat or whatever. He did not necessarily take pigeons out of a hat. What do you
No.
mean by magic?
Well, as I was saying, it's not what they used to call prestidigitation, so stuff you do with your fingers. No, he actually wanted to. He did. This is he made it his life mission to sort of revive what he called like the ancient science of magic, which is this ceremonial magic or the means by which one can. Well, I mean, his definition of magic is I forget what it is now. The science and art by which one can make changes in conformity with will. So actually, it was a way in which you can make changes in the world. So this is the old school actual magic kind of stuff. Not oh, we can just not illusion, not we can just explain it. Actual what we would call the paranormal. But Dean Radin, in a book a few years back, he called real magic, where he basically says what science knows about paranormal and parapsychological phenomena tallies up very well with historical accounts of what we consider magic. So telekinesis and synchronicities. I mean, my own definition of magic is that it is induced synchronicity. So if you know Jung's notion of synchronicity, I'm sure you do, is what, meaningful coincidence, but can you make a meaningful coincidence happen? So that would, consciously, purposefully. So that would be, to me, a definition of magic. And Crowley, he was a wild, tearaway, mad, bad, and dangerous to know kind of character, what we would call, transgressive, very transgressive these days, sexually, he was, experiment with drugs. He came from a strange background. He had his parents, were these very, very fundamentalist Christians, known as the Plymouth Brethren. Particular sect, and they were so strict. They thought Christmas was a pagan holiday and should not be observed. But then they were very rich. His father, who
Well,
was
that helps.
well, I'm saying they're very rich. His father had inherited this brewery, and in the late 19th century into the early 20th century, there were these kind of what they call ale houses called Crowley's Ale, where you could get a pint of beer and a sandwich. So they were kind of that they fit this in sort of intermediary realm between fancy restaurants and just, kind of disreputable pubs or something like that. And so his father had inherited this money, and then Crowley inherited that. And he actually came into quite, what considered sort of millions of pounds at the back then. And he blew that very, very quickly.
Yeah, right,
Well,
sure.
I mean, right, because he published these sumptuous, Vanity Press editions of his poetry, and he went, he lived like, big. He lived it big. He sort of traveled around the world. He climbed, and funnily enough, he actually was quite a good mountaineer. I mean, he was eccentric mountaineer, but he actually achieved some, there were some records that he broke and things like that. He was a chess master. I think in my book about him, which is Aleister Crowley, Magic, Rock and Roll, and the Wickedest Man in the World, I say that he would have made a much better scientist because he had that predilection for this kind of acute, exactness that came out in a kind of weird way in him. But he had this kind of acuity, like things had to be exact, but somehow, that all got mixed up with his own psychological kind of slightly sociopathic personality, where he was completely oblivious to other people's, needs and feelings. And this was his whole philosophy of dilemma. I mean, but I got interested in, as I said, when I was living in the Bowery, on the Bowery in this loft with this fellow, I started reading the books. And then I got seriously involved in it a few years later, when I had left New York and I had left Blondie, and I started my own band called The Know, KNOW, and this was because of my interest in Gnosticism, which I was reading about Gnosis and all that sort of thing. And there used to be this wonderful bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard called Gilbert's. I moved to Los Angeles at this time, on Vine, Hollywood and Vine, actually. And people like Kenneth Anger, the Crowleyite film avant-garde filmmaker, and David
Yeah.
Bowie and Jimmy Page were clients. And I'd go there and I would buy books because I was interested in all this stuff, and I just was a voracious reader. But I saw in the old days before the internet, there was an old bulletin board. There was a little notice for a Crowley group, and I thought, well, I've been reading about this stuff for a few years now. Let's see what happens. So I was all of 22 at the time, and I just wrote to them, and not long after, somebody turned up at the door of the house I was living in, and asked me if I was ready to, devote myself to the knowledge and conversation of my holy guardian angel. I had
Oh,
to think
wow.
about it for how to think about it. It was sort of like a Jehovah's Witness asking if you wanted to join, so I had to think about it for a minute.
A Jehovah's Witness of the occult.
And I said, okay. I said, okay, right. So I did that. And then for, I don't know, about a year or so, I got involved. But it all kind of went sour. Because even though I've met many people that are serious Thelemites, that are serious, followers of Crowley's religion. And they actually do what they wilt. Many interpret that as do what you like, which sadly Crowley himself did in many ways. He was not a good person to know, never lent him money, things of that sort. And the people I got involved with, one person in particular was actually rather like this, and it all kind of went bad and all that. But I outgrew it fairly quickly because, I mean, he's interesting. He's a wonderful raconteur. I mean, his confessions are it's just a great read because he's very good writing about himself. But after a while, it becomes claustrophobic. It was kind of all roads, you know, led to Crowley. He was completely obsessed with himself, and he never outgrew this Edwardian need to kind of, you know, épater la bourgeoisie to shock people. And this must have come from his, you know, Christian background and all that. So, I mean, I was brought up Catholic, but none of that really meant anything to me at that point. So I outgrew it. And then the next thing I got involved with, as you mentioned, was the Gurdjieff work, which certainly was a few years later.
Let's take a brief break here, folks. We'll listen to these ads, and you can probably guess what they are because I really do need to sit down and do some new commercials. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. And just before we left the air for those on the free feed, we were getting ready to talk about something that's a big part of my life, as most of you know, and the Gurdjieff work, and which had a major role to play in my eventual the building of my relationship with the visitors. And I don't want to discuss that now. I've discussed it plenty of times. This sensing exercise in the Gurdjieff work is what attracted them, their attention to me in the first place. But let's talk, which my listeners mostly know about. I'm not going to discuss that. But I want to talk about how did you come to the work? You went to the work in Paris for a while, didn't you?
Well, I not I was involved in it first in New York. This would have been 1981, and
Gosh, we
then
were in
later.
the. I was too. We never crossed paths, though, at the foundation, I don't think.
Well, that was a short time because I relocated to London. Sorry, I moved around so much. I relocated to Los Angeles in 1982.
I see.
So I was involved for a brief time in 1981. I seem to remember the meeting places. My group was somewhere off Lexington Avenue, sort of in the lower 60s, and
Yeah, 63rd Street.
yeah, exactly,
I know it well. I
and
spent many an hour there.
yeah, and as I mentioned in the book, the group leader was Paul Reynard, who was one of the leading instructors of the dances, and in the
Yeah, I
film
taught.
Peterbrook
I
film. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I taught. He taught me movements.
Well, there you go. Well, he's
Paul
going to say
Reynard.
he's one of the principal instructors, and in the Peter Brook's
Yes.
film, "Meetings with the Remarkable Men," he's in there. So, I mean, I recount that in the book, and it was remarkable meeting him. He had this fantastic presence, it was a
Peter
remarkable
Brook
thing.
or
No, I didn't mean
Paul?
Peter Brook, but Paul Reynard. Paul Reynard.
Yeah,
I meant
Paul
to
did
say,
have. I know. I never met Peter Brook personally.
yeah. Well, it was a funny thing because I moved back and forth between LA and New York a lot in the late 70s and early 80s. And at one point, I was back in New York, living in the East Village on 10th Street, just off Second Ave, right near the Second Avenue Deli, if you remember
Yeah, sure.
that. The fellow I was subletting the place from, he himself was involved in the work, but I didn't know. Somehow through conversations, no, what had happened, I actually attended, well, here's the thing. There was Weiser's bookshop, down in Cooper Union, in New York, the one of the great, you know, classic occult bookshop in New York. And, there used to be these people, they were known as the people of the bookmark because they called themselves the Gurdjieff-Uspensky Center. And they used to put bookmarks in all the fourth way literature. And I still have some of them, and I use them as bookmarks. But back then, I actually I attend I, they were advertising for a talk, and it was at the Barbizon Hotel. So I went to this talk and was listened to it because I'd become interested in Gurdjieff from reading about it in Colin Wilson. He wrote about it in The Occult. He did a little book called The War Against Sleep that came out in 1980. That was a short little, kind of, very, very, very simple account of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and all that. I was Uspensky, I have to say, not so much in terms of how he taught it rather than Gurdjieff taught it, but I was drawn to him just because of his earlier work too, like Tertium Organum and New Model of the Universe and Strange Life of Ivan Sokin and things of that sort. And I just thought, okay, just like I had done with Curly, I thought, okay, well, never the armchair philosopher. Let's go see what this is all about. And so I went to this talk, and then I mentioned it to this friend, and he said, well, actually, that's rubbish. But if you're interested in the real thing, call this number. So even that was kind of like, oh, strange. You didn't tell me about this before. Now you know. And then I called, and it was Paul Renard. And then I wound up going to his flat, which is around the same neighborhood as where the meetings were. And it had, it was, as you might expect, that, Oriental decor. And he was a painter, so many of his paintings are on the wall and all that. And I can't say I knew him well, but at that meeting, it was at this point I had already, been in Blondie. I had it written like gold records, had my own band, all this kind of stuff. And so, as they say here, I felt chuffed. As they say, it was kind of, I'm okay. And then he basically asked me the question, well, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to get involved? Which was actually a much more difficult question to answer than I thought. And I hemmed and hawed and some lamely said, well, I want to wake up or something like that. And he said, well, okay, that will take time. And do you think you can
Yes,
really,
it takes a
you
little
do you
time,
think you
all
can
right.
really commit yourself to it? And I thought, okay, yeah, let's go. So I started going to these meetings in 63rd Street. And then one of the last things I did there in New York was I was invited to a Gurdjieff celebration. And it was they celebrate on January 13th. It's his birthday,
Yes.
so I guess that's the old calendar. It was somewhere out of the city, and I was surprised to be invited because I hadn't been involved with that long. But I was invited, and went with this friend and some other people in a sedan driving out of the city quite a bit, And it was at a big estate kind of house, and we did the toast to the idiots with the vodka and all of that kind of thing. And then they tell the story in the book is that there was an announcement that for a special occasion we would be treated to a performance of Gilgamesh, and this was put on by the actor Bill Murray from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, Bill
And
was in the work. He may still be in
yeah, I know, but for me, I didn't know that. So
the
I'm there, I'm there, and I'm like, I'm my essence is coming out after my personality after knocking about quite a few of these vodkas, and then suddenly I see Bill Murray up there, and I have to say, whenever he said Enkidu, I had it's hard for me not to laugh, and it was like, who knew? But subsequently, if you know the films, I mean, Groundhog Day, people say this isn't the case, but I always thought, isn't this Ivan Sokin? Isn't this recurrence? But then, also, he did this remake of The Razor's Edge, the old film with Tyrone Power. Back in the 40s, in the early, he did a remake of that. And there's some scene in that where he does this kind of thing where you speak ill of the dead somehow, which I remember that was kind of, I forget what it is, it's the way of something, I forget, in the tradition. So you kind of, moving them on. Don't hang around here anymore. Move on to the next kind of thing. So after seeing him at this performance, I looked back at some of the films and said, oh, I can see this. But I knew people in later when I moved to Los Angeles, I knew people in the acting world who were involved in that, because that was one of the things that drew them, this kind of role playing and psychodrama sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a lot of people in the creative communities of the world are involved with the foundation, and but it's quite private in the sense that, well, for example, Pamela Travers, the author of Mary Poppins, was deeply involved, but when you read her biography, it's not even mentioned.
Yeah.
We
Well,
have.
I actually saw her give a lecture in London about the symbolism of the bee, the beehive.
Yeah, she
And
was a one. We were very close friends. I have a whole bunch of letters from her. We spent a lot of time together when she was in New York, so I know you her well. I mean, as well as anyone who saw her
Oh
twice a
yeah,
for
sure.
2 weeks
But
would know her.
I mean, seeing this lecture, this was part of what I later came to call my mini search for the miraculous. In 1983, with someone else, it was a good friend, close friend, who was in the work as well, and we went on this kind of European adventure, and part of which was going to the site of the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in the Prairie in Fontainebleau, in this old chateau. In the forest and all that, so that was remarkable. I mean, there was all locked up. There was nothing there, and it's kind of, but we were able to walk around and all that. And there's the plaque about Catherine Mansfield and the forest philosophers and all that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, that this I mean, and then also a couple years later, I was able to go in New York. Well, actually, New Jersey. This place called Franklin Farms in Mendham, which is where Uspensky sort of retreated to escape the Blitz here in the 40s, and then later came back here. So, I mean, I was involved in it for about 5 years, and I learned a lot from it, and I appreciate all the time I spent in it. But I guess
Yeah,
I'm too
I get
I'm too eclectic a kind of thinker, and I'm always interested in other things, and the other things kind of drew me away.
that. I have just recently quit for about the fifth time. I'm involved in it since 1969, and I'll probably be get involved in it again sooner or later. But I ended up in a group that became extremely head oriented, and to me, the work is mostly attention. It's mostly about the body and the relationship between first and second body. And they didn't know anything about that. They didn't know what Gurdjieff meant by the severing of the organ Kundebuffer or anything. And to me, that's the key to everything. So anyway, but that's let's go on now. You have I want to go back to the whole idea of the substance of the esoteric. Like in my life, it's very physical. And I've had these abductions and whatnot that have happened to me. I wrote Communion about them. And I'm still very, very involved on that level. And I'm wondering if you have a level of how exactly how your involvement works now. What happens and what do, if I may ask?
What do I do? Do I have a practice?
Yeah.
Well, I guess yes and no. I mean, actual something I do every day or whenever I remember them is write down my dreams. That's something I certainly do. And I have to say, any sort of paranormal experience I've had have been through dreams or synchronicity. So a few years back, I did a book called Dreaming Ahead of Time, which is about my experiences with precognitive dreams, which I started recording back when I was a musician back in New York, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and carried on until now. I've got a stack of journals with dream records in them. And I came to write that book over the first COVID lockdown here in 2020. Because I had given a talk about hypnagogia, the in-between state. Again, something else that I try to. When I was younger, I used to be able to hover in it longer. It's a bit more difficult now as I'm older, I find. But still, some have some of it in the morning, waking up. And but I gave a talk about that, and that state is conducive to parapsychological phenomena and mostly precognition. And so I just tacked on some accounts of precognitive dreams and some of my own at this talk. And then somebody, when I went on Twitter, somebody had been at the talk. The first thing I saw was a tweet of this person saying that I listened to this guy who said if I wrote my dreams down, I'd see the future. And my God, he's right. And then she told me, she said, she I don't know how she got this on one tweet. So she must be somebody who paid for it. got the extended version. But she said something like, "Yeah, I dreamt that I had walked out my door and picked up a hedgehog, these strange animals that they have here in Britain, and it was in the street, and I picked it up and I put it in a bush, you know, so it would be safe." That was her dream. And then when she went on social media in the morning, the first thing she saw was a post about how to protect the hedgehogs. So she had, I would say, she had a precognitive dream about seeing that post,
Yeah,
which is
exactly.
one might. But what you see is your own future. You don't necessarily Criswell predicts. It's not like you predict what's going to happen. It's like you see bits and pieces of your own future. So this started happening back when I was living in New York. And funnily enough, my chronology might be off, but I had this near-death experience in the sense of I had picked up a lamp in this loft space we were in, and there was a short in it, and I was being electrocuted, and there was no one around me in the loft. I was in this room by myself, and I couldn't speak. I was paralyzed, and I didn't see any tunnel, but I saw a black cloud back here coming closer and closer over me, and I thought, my God, once that gets kind of up front, I'm fried, I'm done for. And luckily enough, the guitarist Chris Stein just out of nowhere, because he could not have heard me saying anything, walked out of the back room, saw me, and just pulled the plug. But it was sort of after that that, like, when we went on our first tour. Sorry, I'm giving you all this backstory to this, but when we went on our first, the first big Blondie North American tour, we were the support act for Iggy Pop, and my girlfriend and I, Lisa, at the time, whenever I wanted to call her, she wanted to call me, and this was back in the day where you had to be someplace to make a phone call and be
Right.
someplace to get the phone call. None of, what we have these days. Each of us would have been ready to call the other. So I would have been about to pick up the phone to call her when it rings and she's calling me, or vice versa. And then we would talk about dreams, and there was some shared stuff. I can't remember exactly what the content was, but that was the thing. And that became the inspiration for the song, I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear, which was a big hit in the UK and in Europe. So I mean that I continue to do a practice of that these days, but I try to apply, in everyday life, I guess. So I mean, I've been actually writing a book about this now. The working title is That We Forget That We Exist, which is not bad off that we don't not far off from we don't remember we fail to remember ourselves. But
Yeah.
and it's if you can kind of like today, Thursday, I clean my flat on Thursdays. So I take that as an opportunity to try to use that as a kind of self-remembering meditation. So however reluctant I am to go and start dusting and vacuuming, I overcome the reluctance, and then I put myself into what I'm doing. And then it actually becomes kind of pleasurable because I'm doing it. I'm doing it.
I know the feeling, and they teach that at work too.
Well, that's it. So you are doing it rather. I mean, the way I tend to see it is more just because it's he's been a huge influence on me, but Colin Wilson's work, and he talks about the robot, which is this labor-saving evolutionary device that we developed over time to take care of all sort of the hard, the grunt work. So whenever you learn to tie, ride a bicycle, speak a foreign language, whatever it is, it's incredibly difficult as you first start doing it. And you have to be there. You have to pay attention. You have to see where you're putting your finger. And then at some point, well, Gertrude would say mechanic, what moving center takes over or whatever, and intellectual center can be thinking about something else. What do I want to type? Where do I want to go with the bike? What do we want to say in French? So it's a higher order thing. But this robot is so good. It's an over-efficient valet who wants to take care of everything. And in slowly, involuntarily, we tend to give over everything to the robot until we're mechanical, like Gurdjieff says. And then we start to
Right.
ask, as T.S. Eliot said, where is the life we have lost in living? Why is everything stale, flat, and unprofitable? Well, it's because you aren't doing it. The robot's doing it. So Wilson came up with this. For him, he discovered this empirically, that one thing that can throw the robot off is inconvenience. And as we know, Gurdjieff was a master of creating inconvenience. He was a master of creating artificial chaos. And in this book about Morris
Yes.
McCall, And I had access to these diaries that Nicole has, and that they're up in the University of Edinburgh, and his accounts of being there, in the priory. It's all about nobody knows what's going on. Is there really an institute here? It's sort of
Yeah.
like, where is the institute? Everything is kind of like shifting and sliding and around, and Gurdjieff's saying something different to everybody, and everyone's on their toes constantly. So he was a master of creating kind of situation where your robot doesn't have any time to settle in, and you are there. And it must have been a remarkable time for people, and they did remarkable things, like build that study house and things like that. But it's nothing on that same level. But I try to apply that kind of awareness to kind of everyday things, and I'm not that successful at it, but occasionally I am.
Well, I think being successful at it is always an illusion in a sense, in that if it's not surprising, it's not entirely real. And
That's no, absolutely. That's the essence of this book I'm working on now. That you nailed it. That's actually it. That's absolutely it.
That's the direction of awakening, of true awakening. I want to get back to rock and roll, and there are quite a number of people who went into rock and roll and then moved into esoteric directions of esoteric studies, magic, and so forth and so on. Some of them very, very underground about it. Chuck E. Weiss, do you know his work at all? He
Know
used
the
to,
name, but not at all. No, I don't know his work.
used to perform at the Viper Club here in on Sunset, and
All right. Well, I know the Viper Room. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah,
Viper Room.
I've
Yeah, that's right. And I never could. I had a couple of contacts with him. I never could tell whether he was sort of shining me on because he knew I was in, fairly advanced in the occult, or exactly what was going on. But in any case, that's neither here nor there. What I'm interested in is where the music, did the music take you here, do you think, or
Oh,
not?
no, it was the books. No, it was the books. It was the
It
books.
was the books.
It was the books. It was the books. I mean, I said, once I read Wilson's The Occult, it was the page turner. I couldn't put it down. This book is unputdownable. And I was just completely, I mean, I had, as I said, read Hesse, and I had this high school teacher who was giving me Sartre to read, and I had discovered Walter Kaufmann's translations of Nietzsche, and I was reading those and all this kind of stuff, not understanding all of it. I mean, I wasn't a wunderkind, but I was reading it. I wanted to get, so I had a kind of background in that kind of, pop existentialism, Zen, D.T. Suzuki, Hesse. And then Wilson's book kind of had all that, plus all these other people I'd never heard about, like Crowley, like Madame Blavatsky, like Gurdjieff, like Uspensky, like Rasputin, like Yeats and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and so on and so on, and also just taking it back into history. I mean, if you haven't read it, it still stands up, I think, as one of these good kind of, this is just a good read, book. And he, in that book itself, he talks about something he called Faculty X, which he didn't have a name, but it was something he called our ability to grasp the reality of other times and places, which is not nostalgia. But his classic example is, if in the beginning of Proust's novel, Recherche au temps perdu, where the character tastes the cake dipped in a little, tisane, a little herb tea, and
Right.
suddenly he has this fantastic memory and he doesn't know what it is, and oh, he's brought back to his childhood holidays. And it's not as if he factually knew that he went to Cambrai and had the holidays there, but suddenly it's not the factual memory, it's this 3D HD, whatever you want to call current attempts, artificial attempts to create reality that, is never quite as real as when it really is real. So, but it's just suddenly, reality is not what's, reality exceeds what's immediately present to us. We're hypnotized by what's right in front of our face, but reality is beyond that. But it's not the senses that grasp that reality, it's some other faculty. Imagination isn't quite the right word because, that can slip into fantasy and all that. But I had those experiences. I knew what he was talking about, and I thought, okay, I know what he's talking about here. So that kind of led me to go read all of the books he wrote before, and then I made this pilgrimage to his home in Cornwall in 1983, after going to the Prairie and Fontainebleau and places like Glastonbury and Avebury and Stonehenge. I was totally into ley lines and megaliths at the time, and I had my ordnance survey map with me, and trying to track, ley lines and where the next standing stone was. But I made this pilgrimage down to Cornwall to meet Colin Wilson.
And you met him.
Oh yeah, met him, and then since then we
I'd
carried
love to have
on.
met him. Can tell us a little bit about Colin Wilson.
Well, Colin Wilson, he came to fame at the age of 24 in 1956 with his first book, came out, be 70 years next year, called The Outsider. And this was a study in extreme mental states of these characters that had a deep hunger and appetite and need for meaning and purpose in the world that can no longer provide this, the secular world, geared towards materialism and comfort and things of that sort. And people like Hesse and Nietzsche and Sartre and Hemingway and Camus and all these others. And he was actually one of the first ones to write about Gurdjieff, who not involved in the work. So this would have come out in 56. The books that had come out after that, it would, Beelzebub's Tales, supposed miraculous, Kenneth Walker's books. But Wilson was one of the first ones to write about it outside of, the people who were involved in it. And it was strange overnight bestseller in England, of all places, which is a country not necessarily that interested in sort of existential ideas and about meaning and purpose and all this sort of stuff. And then there was a backlash against him, and because he wasn't interested in politics and he was interested in sort of religious questions and existential questions and meaning and that sort of thing. And he just kept writing, and he developed this whole, it's not a system, but a body of work that he called, he was trying to develop a new existentialism, positive existentialism. I mean, I wound up writing a book about him called Beyond the Robot, Beyond the Robot, The Life of Work and Colin Wilson. So it's out of print, but it's coming back into print soon. And he had a second sort of career when he was asked in the late 60s to write a book about the occult, because there had been this revival of interest in the occult that started with this book, The Mourning of the Magicians, in 1960 in France, of all places.
An
Louis
incredible book
Pauli.
in itself.
I'm sorry?
The Mourning of the Magicians is an incredible book in itself.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
Absolutely.
and it's the book that you never thought to have been a bestseller where and when it was, because it appeared in 1960 in the Paris of Sartre and Marxism, and everything's black and white and berets and jetons and all that. And suddenly it's like, as I said in my book, it's like a UFO had landed in front of the Café du Mego. Suddenly it's a book about UFOs. It's about alchemy. It's a book about Gurdjieff. It's about Crowley, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, all this kind of stuff that hadn't yet been packaged in a way and presented to the public where, he had Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, and T.C. Lampbrand's books about, Tibet, but they had a readership. But this was like a big, big book. And as you know, it was a bestseller. And it kickstarted this whole interest in the 1960s about the occult. By the mid-decade, 1967, the most famous people in the world were into it, the Beatles, because they had Crowley on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's with Jung, Aldous Huxley, and other figures. So this became sort of the center of, all this was happening. And Wilson was asked to write a book about this. And his first, thought was like, well, I've always had an interest in spiritualism and all this kind of stuff. And he wrote a book about Rasputin. Crowley was a character in one of his early novels, but he always kind of tongue in cheek. He was an existentialist, and he sort of, well, this is probably mostly a lot of, self-deception. But as he did the research for the occult, he became convinced. And he just became convinced there's enough statistical evidence for this stuff to say it's not about rubbish, it's not, superstition, it's real. And then he started to apply existential phenomenological kind of analytical discipline that he had to his earlier books to the occult. And that's what I picked up on when I read this book, because it wasn't just a book about spells and ghosts. It was him trying to understand, what does this mean about human consciousness? If these things are possible, what does this mean about consciousness? So that's what I go, yeah, what does that mean? And I wanted to experience these other states that he was talking about.
Those of us on the you on the free side, we're going to be saying goodbye now, and we'll stay with Colin because I'm very interested in getting a little deeper into something we touched on earlier, which is your interest in magic and whether or not it practical magic, because I've had some experiences with this too, and I know it is real, but it's also very elusive. And I have a feeling that my listeners and viewers on YouTube will be interested in what you have to say about whether or not it works and how. So stay with us, subscribers, and those of you on the free side, thank you very much for joining us on Dreamland as always. Okay, magic. Let me give you an idea of what I know about magic and in a practical sense. And I thought we might be able to play off of that rather than just asking abstract questions. We have a lot of fires out here in California, which I'm sure you're well aware of. And a few years ago, there was a terrible fire in Malibu, where I have loads of friends, including a friend, Lee McCloskey, who's.
I know Lee very well.
You do know Lee.
I haven't been there for years, but I've been to his place
Oh,
out in
well,
Malibu.
everything is going great there. We're still meeting every Tuesday night. And if you ever come to LA, you've got to do it.
Stosh, right,
And you
as
know
well.
Stash
Well,
Giroli.
I haven't met him, but we know correspondence, through correspondence.
Oh, he's one of my best friends.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Isn't it strange how we intersect in these ways? Stash is a folks, Stash Giroli, you can find him on Instagram as Prince Stash. And I urge you to look him up. Stash is a trip of major proportions. He his father was the artist Balthus, and he owns a huge castle about 50 miles north of Rome. And he's so much fun. He's really so much fun. And you'll really enjoy his Instagram. Okay, now. But let's go on here. Let me tell you what happened at Lee's. This terrible fire was coming down from the hills, burning everyone out. I lost 17 friends in Malibu, lost their homes, along with hundreds of other people. And it was horrible. And many of these homes were extraordinary, beautiful places. And we're here in this flat, a group of Lee's friends and followers, which I certainly count myself among, and we are doing magic that I learned, and I'm unfortunately not able to say I've taken a vow of silence about who I learned it from or what it is, but we're doing magic together, and the fire is now coming. We don't know this because of the fact that the cell phones are all out, and we only know that Lee and Carla, or his wife, are still at the house and trying to save it. That's all we know. We can't go in. It's all closed. You can't get any cell phone coverage or anything. So we're doing magic. This happens. Lee and Carla are there with hundreds of fire extinguishers, desperately trying to save this house, which contains one of the great artworks of the world in it, created by Lee, called The Hieroglyph of the Human Soul. I'm going to put some pictures up of the hieroglyph in this part of the show. Anyway, we don't know this. The fire reaches literally the fence line, and Lee and Carla are realizing we have to leave when unexpectedly a helicopter comes and completely douses the flames just on the other side of the fence line while we are doing this magic. And not a single leaf on a single tree at Olindar was even singed, and the house still stands, and the beautiful gardens and everything. Now, I don't know if there's a connection between what we did and what happened or not, but I think you have a lot of ideas about magic, and I'd like you to talk about them.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if what you were doing did have an effect. You don't necessarily know what's going to happen. I mean, I technically practicing magic, I haven't done for many, 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 many years. But as I said earlier, if someone's going to ask me my definition, I say it would be induced synchronicity. Somehow you make a synchronicity happen.
Yeah.
You know, something you want to happen that's up here, going on in there, in here, and all that, and it happens out in the out world. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if that had happened. I don't know if it can be as fine-tuned as we would like it to be. I think with Crowley, I think this again, I think he knew that if he worked himself up into a certain state, something would happen. It might not be, you know, but so, he had unconscious, intuitive, instinctual notion. I think that if he worked himself in energized enthusiasm, if he worked himself up in some kind of, you know, inflame yourself with prayer, invoke often, you know, like you got, if you have to have that, you have to have that kind of, and I think that's one of the prerequisites. If it's something you're going to really try to do often, you have to have that one-mindedness. You really have to have that. And most of us don't have it, thankfully, because you're interested in other things, you know. So, but you really have that kind of, and as I said, Crowley had this acuity, this kind of, he was able to, he was a bad enemy because he would hold a grudge for years and years and years and finally get you at the right time. It could be a pain in the ass, but it also is something that works well in another context. So MacGregor Mathers, who was the head of the Golden Dawn when Crowley joined, he was another one who was like this as well. Yeats, who was W.B. Yeats, the, you know, famous poet, Nobel Prize winner, who was in the Golden Dawn as well. But there's a whole story of him doing some ritual, you know, they're walking around the circle and he's like passing a fruit bowl and he's like picking up a plum every time he goes. Well, the other person says, William, we can't, when this is, you can't keep eating fruit while we're doing the ritual. So he seemed not to have that kind of one-pointedness, but I think that worked for him in his poetic work because he was receptive. Whereas I think
It
Crowley
is
wasn't
remarkable.
oh no, what I'm saying, but Crowley wasn't receptive. He fancied himself a great poet, but he wasn't because he'd never get rid of himself. So what worked for him
Right.
in magic didn't work for him in poetry. Likewise with Yeats, what worked for Yeats in poetry didn't work for him in magic. So and I have to say, well, I did a book about this in a political context, came out a few years ago called Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. And it was about Trump's first administration, where there
Right.
seemed to be all this weird kind of occult politics around, where there were people actually using the internet in order to make things happen, like get Trump
There,
elected.
there's a lot of occultism in the. I'm not. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay,
Suffice to
I'm
say,
just saying.
this
No,
is an
I'm
occult administration
yeah,
out the
no,
wazoo.
yeah. No, I just mentioned, since this was like a recent context, where I was looking at practices that aimed at making something happen. Because most of the magic I was got involved in when I was involved in with Crowley, it was about the knowledge and conversation of a holy guardian angel. So it's not about making stuff happen out in the world. It was more meditative than a kind of inner
Yes.
spiritual experience, where chaos magic and positive thinking, they're all about making stuff happen in the world. And I agree with you. I think you're totally right. This is one of the strange things that nobody picks up on in order to, you know, really get what's going on. But yeah, let's pass on from that. But no, I think it's real. I mean, I think if the statistical, like Dean Radin says in his book, the statistical evidence for these sorts of things is so overwhelming that if it was about anything else, no one would bat an eye about it. So it happens. But I'm more of a naturalist. I don't necessarily want to make stuff happen. I want to see what happens. And that's like, in a way, you know, you can use dreams, you can learn how to lucid dream, you can learn how to have certain kinds of dreams in order to, but I'm more interested, like, well, let's just see the dreams emerging themselves. So that's more of a Jungian kind of thing, like, but they're natural phenomena rather than my applying pragmatic utilitarian, you know, views on them. So I'm concerned about a utilitarian approach to consciousness and all this kind of stuff. I think that strikes me too much of the ego. Like, you want to use it to make something happen, and I'm
Yeah,
wary of that.
that's usually why it doesn't work, because the ego gets involved and people want to be impressive or whatever, and that's not going to ever work. You mentioned, well, you know, there, I want to go here, go before I go there. I'm at where I, you don't yet know where it is, but it's no big deal. You'll find out in a minute. I wanted to just mention in passing that Kenneth Anger did a really, really eerie and powerful movie called Invocation of My Demon Brother. The first soundtrack was done by Mick Jagger, who was really into that sort of thing at one point in his life. And I'd love to interview him, but in any case, the Invocation of My Demon Brother is the most powerful depiction of that kind of magic performance I've ever seen, because mostly it's secret. And and you see in the, you can see in the performance that the magic is real in some sense. The one that's up on YouTube now is does not have the original soundtrack, and the original soundtrack is not music really. It's just this da 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 da, and it's really powerful. He took that off, Ken did, and I guess he realized that it was maybe dangerous.
Well, I mean, I think he also maybe he had a falling out with Jagger as well. So he, I mean, I interviewed Kenneth Anger a couple of times. I can't say I knew him well, but he like Crowley, he's one of these vindictive kind of characters where, you know, he
Yeah,
holds a
that's
grudge.
right.
So, but no, that is a powerful, powerful work, and it's very disturbing work. I mean, he, you
Very.
know, other works like Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, an earlier one, which is kind of a Crowley ritual on celluloid, and Ais Nin has a part in it, and all this kind of stuff. And then later on, it was God, is it, what is it, Aquarius Rising? Which one rising? I forget. Scorpio Rising? No, Lucifer. Excuse me, Lucifer Rising,
Lucifer
which was
Rising, yeah.
the long-awaited one, which is this kind of millenarian vision of some Aquarian New Age and all that. But I don't know. Do you know the films of Alejandro Jodorowsky? Do you know his work? He was a Chilean French filmmaker. He's still around. But he did this. I mentioned it because I've just been asked to write a kind of short introductory thing for a Australian Blu-ray edition of his films. But he is out and out. I mean, like Anger, but in a different kind of way. He's out and out occult symbolism in this film of his called The Holy Mountain, which is vaguely, not exactly, but kind of vaguely based on Mount Analogue, René Dommard, but not really, just
Yeah.
in the general sense of some holy mountain to climb. And it's a shocking, transgressive film. There's lots of very shocking stuff in it. So it was the kind of thing that, you know, it's not an easy film to watch, but there are. He was involved with Oscar Richazzo, who Rika, like in the 60s and 70s, and kind of the Enneagram work kind of got leaded into that. So that the Enneagram symbol turns up quite a bit in this film. So if you get a chance, it's called The Holy Mountain. It might be on YouTube. I'm not sure, but no, I mean,
I'll take a
you
look.
know, I mean, Anger's film. I mean, Anger was one of the people who kind of ushered in Crowley and the magic into the pop world, because
Yeah,
people,
that's why I keep bringing him up.
Rolling Stones became friends with him, and he came out of Haight-Ashbury and in the same milieu where Anton LaVey, you know, in the Church of Satan, and Manson, and a variety of other people who had subsequent careers came out, and Anger wound up coming to London. And he got into this sort of scene here where the Stones were hanging out. And yeah, he became close friends with them and all that. So that's one way where Jagger got to do the film. I mean, he wanted Jagger to like play the part in one of the films, but he backed out. So what he did was kind of like, I think with Jagger was a good tactician. I mean, he sort of, I say this in this book, Turn Off Your Mind, right? I think he sort of saw the rise of this occult interest in the pop culture, and so Sympathy for the Devil and things like that. He kind of saw that, but then it all kind of exploded, you know, with the disastrous concert at Altamont, where the Hells Angels, you know, wound up killing somebody. And then earlier than that was the Manson murders, but it wasn't until early 70 that the police found out that it was Manson and the family who were responsible. So that was kind of the end of that dream of the 60s,
Yeah.
liberation kind of dream, and it had this sour end.
And
But
then
yeah.
from there you go down a real rabbit hole, and you find people like Jolly West, the CIA officer who was playing around with fire in the hate, and that is to say, dosing up people with LSD, and I think probably caused the Manson catastrophe.
Certainly could very well be the case.
Could
So,
easily have done that.
yeah.
Now, you mentioned chaos magic a little while ago. I want you to tell our listeners what it is, chaos magic.
Well, as far as I know, chaos magic is a kind of modern or postmodern form of magic that grew up in London, around the same time as punk rock was starting here, the Sex Pistols, sort of in the mid-70s. And just like the punk was kind of do-it-yourself music, you didn't have to be a great musician. You just need to know a few chords and be able to look cool on stage. Chaos magic was like that too. They didn't rely on the old paraphernalia and impedimenta, having the magical circle and getting, the candles and all the weapons and all the elements and getting the name of the demon just right and making sure there was the correct astrological time. So all of these sort of exact, requirements, they basically said, no, we could just make it up for ourselves because what's important is our imagination. And it has roots going back to, say, like someone like, well, Crowley in one sense. There's a story where Crowley, he's on what he called his walk across China, which is kind of like on the border between China and Southeast Asia, and with his wife and actually young infant child. I wouldn't even go down that rabbit hole. The poor child dies at the end of this, but don't go down there. But while he's gone this thing, Crowley is still in the midst of, according to him, still performing this ritual known as the sacred magic of Ebermelin the Mage, which is very extended Kabbalistic. It's again, it's not, at some point you learn how to control the demons, but it's more, it's this is where it's about the knowledge and conversation of the holy guardian angel. That's where this comes from, this whole ritual. So it's about having that experience. And he's left some of it undone. And so while he's on this burrow, whatever he's on, with his wife and kid, he thinks, well, if only I had my magical implement, we could, stop somewhere and I could finish this. But he thought, oh no, why don't I do it all in my mind? So he imagines all the stuff he needs in order to complete the ritual. And so, according to him, he had completed it along this way and he was able to go on to the next step. And the next fellow, the Austin Osmond Spare, was Enfant Terrible in the Edwardian period here in London, artist, very young in his late teens. He was very well known. And the same milieu as someone like Aubrey Beardsley, Oscar Wilde, that kind of period. But he develops a whole magical, his own system of writing sigils, these symbols that he energizes with his imagination. So it's all about the magician's imagination rather than getting everything just right. So
Yes.
chaos magic goes on to like, well, use whatever's available. Whatever's available, use. And it's sort of in the same category as found art. You're walking down the street, you see something in the trash, you pick it up,
Yeah.
you take it home, you put it on your mantelpiece. Now it's art somehow. It struck you. So your act of taking it and renaming it and seeing it in a different way gives it this whole other character. So this, so it's sort of behind that. But the thing about chaos magic is, I understand it's results based. They want to make things happen. So it's not about getting in touch with the guardian angel. It's about making stuff. I need money, or I like that woman, or whatever it might be. You actually want stuff to happen. So old school, kind of sorcery in a way. And the interesting thing to me, the connection I make in this book, Dark Star Rising, is that it's not that far different from what we know as the power of positive thinking, which is a Christianized kind of version of mental science. Thoughts are things. If you
Yes.
focus intently enough on something and imagine it enough and visualize it enough, then it comes into being. But that's results based too. It's something what they call, there's an achievable wish and an actualizable reality, I think, are the sort of the similar phrases that each of these movements use. But it's about making stuff happen in the world.
A very, very good description of it, because of the fact that you touch here on the power in it. You have to, there's a level of trust that has to be there, and the ego has to go aside, or you can't have that trust. You know, someone who's probably the most knowledgeable person I've ever known in terms of the old-fashioned rituals of ritual magic and alchemy is Prince Stash Darola. I mean, just unbelievably knowledgeable, and has a phenomenal collection, and Lee does too, Lee McCloskey, of alchemical, of antique alchemical texts from the 15th century on, with the difference that Lee has them, but Stash can actually read them. And it's quite interesting. I had a run-in in India and ended up getting cursed. And I can see the look on your face. It's a serious business when you're cursed by somebody who knows what they're doing.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. Oh,
So
I
uh,
know.
I had this. I had bought this Ganesha doll. Here it is. This I had bought this beautiful Ganesha, and I was taking it home in the plane, and I opened the very heavily sealed package, and it was a monster. It wasn't that at all. And I thought, my God, I thought I had insulted the man because I didn't take the chai he offered me, and he's because I'm a, Westerner with no validity. He cursed me, and this is why this thing is a monster. I get it to my grandson at the time, and I said, "What does this look like to you?" And he said, "That's not what you bought." And so, Prince Stash and Lee took it over when I got back, and it disappeared from my life, but so did the curse. And now I have the another, this is not the same one, another one. But that's the
Oh,
kind of
fantastic.
thing. Isn't that remarkable?
No, yeah, absolutely. I can't
That's
say
the
I've ever had any experience like that, but no, that's
good.
absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, I'm glad you have.
I accept the world is such that these things happen. Now, I wanted to ask you, do you know Stefan Heller?
No.
Dr. Stefan, oh well, he's the head of the Gnostic Church. He's associated with the PRS, the Philosophical Research Society, out in Los Feliz, in LA. But he's been there forever. I used to see him when I worked at the Bodhi Tree bookshop over in West Hollywood in the 80s and 90s. And he used to have these Friday evenings. And the Gnostic Church used to be on Hollywood Boulevard, east of Vine, so the bad end of Hollywood Boulevard. But no, he's this fantastic Hungarian intellectual. He's in his 90s. But if you ever get a chance, so far as I know, he still gives these Friday evening gatherings at the Annie Besant Lodge up in oh God, what is it, canyon? I can't remember off the top of
Topanga.
my head. Oh no, not Topanga. Over in Hollywood. It'll
Oh,
come
I
to
don't
me. But
remember.
yeah, it's I can't remember right now off the top
Well,
of my
you
head.
blocked on it, and so did
But
I, even though I know someone
if you ever
who's
look
up there.
if you bother to look up the Annie Besant Lodge,
Okay, I'll do that. I'm making a note of it now.
and Dr. Stefan Heller, HOELLER. The reason I say it, he is a remarkable character, and he's in his 90s, so he might not be around for too much longer. Any case, no, I mean, I lived in LA. I moved here beginning of 1996. I've been here, well, it'll be with any luck 30 years this January coming up. But I lived for a long time in LA, and I worked at the bookshop and other places, and had some contact with people there. So the PRS is fantastic. This is Manly P. Hall's thing that he started back in the 1950s. It's this wonderful Mayan Art Deco building that's over in this still interesting part of LA near Griffith Park.
That's, I'd love to go back to live more or less full time in England. There's an area I discovered in Sussex where there's a confluence of ley lines that is so conducive to writing. It's unbelievable. And a lot of there's some very magical people who live there. And I
So
wrote
where
what?
I was going to say, where is this in Sussex? Where?
It's in Sussex. I'm not going to say the name of the community.
Oh, okay. It'll certainly have an
But
influx of
I'll tell
people
you
going
offline because
there.
I don't want to. They're very private,
No,
and
I
about
understand.
that.
Yeah.
And I wrote my book, Them, in 2 weeks there.
Oh,
Two
wow.
weeks. The
That's
book just
amazing.
poured out of me. It was
Wow.
phenomenal. And I've written there again. I go there as much as I can to write. And there are a number of sort of fringe kind of religious groups and so forth there, because they know the secret of this place. And it's also in it's a so anyway, I know you'd probably love to come back to LA, and I'd love to go to England. So we should try.
Well, I mean, I was actually in L.A. And by the way, it's Beechwood Canyon. That's what it is,
Oh, it's
Beechwood
Beechwood
Canyon. I mean,
Canyon. Okay, thank you.
that's where
Yeah.
Annie Besant. So it's over just it's just above Franklin Avenue over
Right, yeah, I know
in
where it is.
Hollywood.
The
Yeah.
Magic Castle's not far from
Yeah,
it.
it's right around there. It's right around there. No,
Yeah.
I just was in L.A. in April because I did some things at this Philosophical Research Society. But no, I mean England's fantastic. I mean one of the things here is that you can get out to Glastonbury, you can get out to Avebury and Stonehenge, and
Yeah.
there's all these other ones, and they're not that far away because it's a small little island place. And I haven't been out to any of these places in a long time, although I was in Glastonbury not that long ago, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and walked the tour, went up to the tower and all that sort of thing, which it still remains, quite a remarkable place, although it is kind of New Age central, but that's to be
It is
expected.
now. You know what I just did just this summer, during the heat wave. I walked Avebury,
Oh.
which is something I've done many times, and it's a couple of those trees there really speak to me. It's a fantastic place. Okay, I think we're coming to the end of our journey. I really don't have any idea how much time we've spent. I hope I made breaks. I'm supposed to make breaks in the first hour. I think my guess is we've talked a long time, and I know I was unfortunately an hour late, which is unlike me in contacting you because there
Well,
was a mistake in my calendar. So, Gary Lachman, Touched by the Presence. I hope you have gotten a flavor of what Gary is like as a person, as a seer, as an intellectual, and above all, as a journey in the edges and in the depths of the shadows, where he is touched by the presence. Gary, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
Thank you. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.